and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Voldana Hayek, a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, everyone has been talking about how higher interest rates are causing the sell-off in technology stocks. But is that the entire story? We'll talk with a veteran equity market strategist who thinks there's more to it than just that. And we'll also pick her brain about the upcoming earnings season. But first, Voldana, I've got a pop quiz for you. Are you ready?
Probably not, but okay.
I know I warned you there'd be a pop quiz and you got very nervous.
I did. So I've been nervous for the past hour.
Yeah.
Since you warned me.
Been nervous for like the past 30 years,
that's, I think. Yeah, but 33.
Especially nervous with the pop quiz. Voldana, as you know, to make a name for yourself in the stock market, you really need to create an acronym of your own. So I've got it. There's a new acronym that I'm a big fan of. I'm going to tell you what it is, and you tell me what it stands for. It's MAGMA. M-A-G-M-A.
Okay. It's Meta, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Apple. In some order. In one of those orders.
It's pretty good. I'm not sure if you got them all in the right order. We'll find out. I kind of feel bad for Alphabet. You know, they're like, look, guys, we changed our name to Alphabet. And everyone's like, no, you're still Google. Sorry.
Same for Meta. We need
that consonant in our acronym.
Meta made its way into the acronym.
That's true. I guess the lesson is, if you're going to change your name, there's enough A's, you need a consonant. But luckily for us, that acronym is courtesy of this week's guest. I think she created it. Maybe she can shed some light on that for us. But, well, Donnie, obviously we like to have strategists on the show a lot, and we're lucky enough to have one of the best in the biz working for us right here in-house at Bloomberg, and very excited to have her on the show.
We really are, and I have noticed that acronym in her recent notes. So I want to welcome back Gina Martin Adams. She's the Chief Equity Strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence. Thank you for joining us, Gina.
Thank you. And I have to say, if I have to live or die by MAGMA, I might be in trouble. Hopefully I can make my name in some other way, shape, or form. But yes, we did come up with MAGMA. And I'll tell you why the G is still there, because Google's ticker, Alphabet's ticker, is still G-O-O-G-L. So it's based on the ticker. That's why we could still have the G in there. And yeah, our team came up with MAGMA. I can't say it's catching fire, forgive the pun, but we're trying.
Wait until the podcast comes out.
Yeah, you know, hopefully we can get that MAGMA to stick.
It's a good one. I've seen a lot of attempts to recreate the FANG acronym, and that's my favorite.
Yeah, so you know, another good one is Ed Yardeni has a Magnificent Seven he's been out there with, because it's really the top seven stocks that everyone talks about instead of the top five anymore. So I'll credit him with that one. We're all struggling with how to describe this giant group of mega caps that really dominates everything in the S&P 500.
Yeah, for sure. And we do want to talk to you about that, because you have been writing a lot of research reports about the big tech companies. But I want to start with just something that's happened this week, which is we heard from Powell this week. And I wanted to ask you if you feel like he actually ended up saying anything new, and why his hearing in front of Congress sort of helped stocks form a bottom from the recent sell-off that we had been seeing at least for a day or two.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, did he really say anything new? I don't think so. I think that the market is incredibly sensitive to anything that happens with the Fed. When they hear from the Fed, they seem to feel better, right? Really, when the market is freaking out is when everyone speculates about what does the minutes mean? What did we read here? And a forecaster comes out and says, we're going to get six hikes instead of three. And that creates a lot of panic. So I think that just hearing his voice and hearing him restate that the Fed is still going to be somewhat measured in their approach, is still going to remain vigilant and consider both sides of their mandate, probably was the trigger. But did he really say anything new? In my opinion, not necessarily. I think that they're pretty consistent in their messaging. But in the days leading up to his speech, the market had gone through a process of perhaps getting a little bit too irrational with respect to Fed expectations. You know, we were pulling forward every possible interest rate forecast, talking about 50 basis point moves instead of 25 basis point moves, and starting to talk about QT and what that might mean, all in the span of a very short time period. So I think if anything, it sort of squelched a little bit of the speculation and allowed the market a minute to just start to breathe again.
I'm glad you brought that up, Chidi. You know, I've had that same thought. I wish someone could almost study that. I don't know how you would do it, but it's like, it seems like if you were to print out a speech and send it out into the market in print form, you'd have one reaction. But if you had Powell just read it in front of the cameras, it would be a completely different reaction. There's something about his soothing tone, I think.
Yeah, and that, I think that...
Or anyone's really. There's something about the hearing someone say it rather than reading it. It comes across more stern.
I totally agree. And I think it's a legacy aspect too, because if you think about how the Fed used to operate, you know, you'd have teams of people inside banks trying to figure out every little language change in a Fed statement and what that might mean for future interest rate increases and what that might mean for future Fed policy. And in the open era of communication, really just the last 20, 30 years here, we've become much more accustomed to constant communication, and we really crave that constant messaging. And so I think there's something to be said for the fact that the personal message, we need it, we want it, we want to hear it all the time. Yeah. We've gotten very spoiled by it. And when there's a vacuum of messaging, the market has a tendency to, you know, revert to its worst self and start to extrapolate extreme potential outcomes.
Reminds me, in the old days, didn't they used to look and try to figure out how heavy Greenspan's briefcase
was
when he was walking? But let's get into it about interest rates in tech. And I noticed that in one of your recent notes. I think it's a really important topic to kind of dissect a little bit. I mean, I think maybe it's partly the media's fault. We tend to shorthand this notion of rates are up, tech is selling off. You know, it's obviously cause and effect there. But your work, you seem to think there's more to it. I mean, obviously, tech long duration stocks are clearly sensitive to interest rates. But in your opinion, it's and the work you've done, it seems like you think there's a little bit more to it, that's not the whole story. Yeah. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you know, what is really the story with tech and this sort of mini correction?
Yeah, I think it is multifaceted, and I thank you for giving me the airtime to discuss it, because I do believe that there is absolutely a tendency, particularly in this environment where rates volatility is coming to the forefront, where the market is naturally going to trade on duration. So your longest duration stocks, like the tech and the high growth stocks, the stocks with much longer dated cash flow growth, are likely to perform much worse than the lower duration stocks like the financials and the energies of the world. That's just a given. That said, when we really analyze what's been happening with tech, and specifically what's been happening with the Magma, the biggest of the tech stocks, we saw this extreme flight into this group throughout 2020 and much of 2021, at least the early part of 2021, really in and sort of seeking safety. And that resulted in this tremendous valuation premium for this group, not necessarily related to interest rates, right? Because for most of 2020 and 2021, long-term interest rates have been slowly rising, albeit in fits and starts, we're certainly off of our lows. So if it were all about duration, why would these stocks have been performing so well when interest rates were initially rising and now all of a sudden not? That's not the entire story, right? So we saw this incredible valuation sort of premium get built into these stocks when there was just an absence of growth and an absence of confidence everywhere else. Really, over the course of the last 6 months or so, we've started to see that valuation premium compress as the market has become a little bit more confident in growth prospects for everyone else outside of this space, and a little less confident that these providers are going to be the dominant providers in the marketplace. As you've had new entrants to the market, you've had a lot more competitive, you know, the competitive environment has changed so dramatically and the like. On top of that, we did see a pretty consequential technical indicator develop in November, where the tech space in particular had gotten so extremely overbought that we were inevitably due for some sort of correction. I mean, it was really clear in that late October, early November rip, when everyone just rushed right back into tech, that this was a sector that was overbought and primed for some degree of correction. So we've been really since the middle of November in a period of time in which this space has been sort of rationalizing that extreme as well. So you've got this multifaceted story going on with tech. It's not just about rates. While I think rates are certainly playing a heavy part, it's a longer term story. It's also a technical story. It's a story of valuations and how those are adjusting to a new reality, and also earnings trends, frankly.
So how do you see that all playing out sort of in the longer term? You know, my guess is that really, you know, high growth tech is always going to command some sort of multiple premium in a sort of normalized environment where, you know, inflation's normal below 2 and GDP is, you know, 2 or whatever, not these off the charts numbers we've seen. I mean, is that a safe bet? And let me dial up one more question on there. I'll make it a two-parter. But the other thing to me seems to be that, you know, what we think about as growth really isn't growth anymore. You know, the magmas aren't really putting up the eye-popping growth that they once did. Is that part of the story?
That is absolutely part of the story. Is how do you really define these magma companies? Are they growth companies or are they value companies? Because a few of them are actually in the value indices, which is kind of compelling information. So how are they really growth or not? You know, I think that the real clarity, you can derive some real clarity by actually looking at the duration of stocks, right? And you can even go into the tech sector and decompose what are the highest duration versus lowest duration stocks. The magmas are not necessarily the highest duration stocks in tech. If you think about what's sold off the most over the course of this most recent rip in rates, it's really been some of the fintech companies, some of the recent IPOs, some of the non-cash companies, right? The companies that aren't even generating cash flow yet, aren't even posting positive earnings growth, right? Those are the companies that are most at risk, whereas magma is kind of a safety play. But relative to the entire S&P 500, they are higher duration, right? So I think that it's all relative in what the universe that you're speaking to that really matters. But I think you make a good point, because when we really look at the growth prospects for magma, that was probably what created the valuation bubble that I alluded to. When you think about sort of pre-crisis, these stocks actually traded at a discount to the rest of the S&P 500. Post-crisis, they've traded at a massive premium. Why have they traded at a premium? Is it really just about interest rates? Probably not. It's mostly because they were pumping through double-digit cash flow growth, really strong earnings growth, still coasting revenue growth in an environment where many companies were in complete distress and were posting negative earnings in some cases. So as we get to an environment where more opportunities emerge and other companies in the S&P 500 and the broader markets at large can produce some earnings growth, the competitive set for investor dollars suddenly changes, right? There are energy companies that I might consider buying now, or financial companies that I might consider buying now that 2 years ago I thought might actually go out of business. So I think that that's a big part of it. But when we look, for instance, over the course of this year, this subset of companies, that five magma companies, is expected to still produce faster revenue growth than the rest of the S&P 500, but slower earnings growth than the rest of the S&P 500. And that's a pretty big contrast to where we were 2 years ago, where they were producing much faster earnings growth and revenue growth than the rest of the index. So that tells you that margins are another part of the story. Is these companies, while their margins are high, they're not getting higher. And you've still got margin growth, really exponential margin growth for some segments of the S&P 500 to enjoy in this early part of the expansion, where this group doesn't have that natural benefit. So I think that that's another headwind that we've got to consider for this group. Just in the short term, doesn't mean that over the long run, they might not be great investment ideas, right? But in the short term, when we're thinking 3, 6, 12 months down the road, it could be pretty choppy for some of these, really big stalwart positions in the S&P.
So I was hoping actually that you would dig into the earnings trends for some of these companies, because I was looking at one of your notes and I watched one of your recent Bloomberg TV interviews, and you had said that if we look at earnings trends, tech is likely to lag over the course of 2022. And your note said the EPS growth pace for these companies may remain below the indexes into the fourth quarter, and that sort of diminishes some of the magma's appeal. So can you go over that for
us? Yeah, absolutely. So when we look out over the landscape of 2022, and this is just referencing what is currently in consensus, a couple of things are working against tech. Number one, companies are guiding us to expect less. So this is something that really evolved with the October earnings season, is all of a sudden, Whereas in the early part of this recovery, companies were persistently guiding analysts to expect more out of them. It was a really positive tailwind for stock prices. In the third quarter, companies suddenly started saying, hey, analysts, maybe you're a little too optimistic. And that really is a reversion to normal times. Pre-crisis, that was the norm. Companies constantly told analysts, you might be a little bit too optimistic. Well, we all know this earnings game where they guide analysts to expect a little less so they can beat every quarter. We've seemed to have reverted back to that norm. But that was particularly a profound change for tech, where that's where the vast majority of the negative guidance started to come from, is all of a sudden the tech companies themselves were saying, you know what, this supply chain distress is going to last a little longer than we were hoping. And even though our sales are pretty strong, they may not be as strong as you were hoping for. And no, we're not going to be able to be as efficient as you had hoped and produce that bottom line earnings growth with margin expansion to the degree that you were expecting. And we see that throughout all most of tech, but especially for the Magma companies, because they are so in the spotlight and they did have such a gigantic valuation premium develop. But if you're just looking out over the next four quarters, for example, that Magma group is expected to post about 800 basis points slower EPS growth than the S&P 500 at large. So significantly slower EPS growth, which is anomalous. Right. This is a group that really persistently beat the S&P 500 in terms of earnings growth right through the middle of 2021.
That seems like a very weird scenario to me, where companies are guiding lower and analysts are raising their estimates. Have you ever seen that before? And I mean, it sounds like you're kind of perhaps side more with the analysts than the management.
So there's always these interesting dichotomies that emerge where there are more companies guiding lower than positive, but we never get 100% of companies giving us guidance as well, right? So we can only derive so much of our expectations from guidance. For tech, it's usually pretty good as an indicator because more tech companies guide than any other sector, save consumer discretionary. So we get some pretty good guidance out of tech. We don't get guidance for all of the S&P 500, though. As a matter of fact, we get guidance from less than 100 companies in the S&P 500. So you can only get so much out of it, but shift in direction can be meaningful. As long as analyst expectations are still moving higher, that's generally the factor that matters more for equity prices and for equity markets at large, because that revision momentum reflects the entire herd of the analyst community for all S&P 500 companies at large. So it's a much bigger and broader and deeper indicator than guidance is. That said, guidance can be meaningful for certain companies, and we certainly want to pay attention to it to some degree, but revisions are more important to follow. And frankly, the other thing to consider from a guidance perspective is just what does it really mean for guidance to be more negative than positive? And as I suggested earlier, we were in a really abnormal position when guidance was more positive than negative. That's where that almost never happens. That's what happened in 2020 and 2021. And I think a big part of why stocks just ripped so hard over the last 2 years is nobody thought we could do this well, including companies themselves. Yeah. And so it came as such an incredible shock.
Yeah, wasn't that there was a situation where so many companies just either pulled their guidance or didn't give any because
they just kind of gave up. They threw the cards in the air and said, forget it, fold.
Yeah. Which makes me wonder, you know, I assume, okay, and, you know, in 2020, 2021, I don't think anyone, you know, in sort of in your type of seat who has to make projections and estimates and sort of predict the future, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming your confidence level in everything was sort of lower than what it would have been, you know, in a non-pandemic environment, certainly. Where's your confidence level now in what you're analyzing for the future? Has it gotten back to that, you know, pre-COVID level? Is it halfway there? You know, how do you think about how confident you are in what you're actually expecting?
You know, your confidence level in predicting market valuations is always low. You know, it's just we all struggle for the holy grail of trying to find that perfect model that tells you where valuation should be. But my regression models, for example, that try to predict the earnings side of the S&P 500 equation versus the multiple side, the earnings model is roughly two-thirds better than the multiple model. There's just no way to know, because when you're predicting the multiple, you're predicting sentiment to a certain degree, obviously. How much are investors going to be willing to pay for this cash flow? over time. I will say that the earnings model, I would argue that you should be more confident that earnings growth will be at least stable to close to double-digit growth over the course of this year. And I would say I'm more confident in our earnings model than I have been in the most recent past because things have finally normalized. When you're coming right into recovery, our earnings model is based on macroeconomic inputs. So we take things like, where is the unemployment rate trending? Well, when the unemployment rate was 20% trending back to 5%, that created a lot of distortion in the model, as you might imagine. And now that we're back to more normalized conditions of unemployment, we can use a model more effectively when it's driven that way. And it's the same with durable goods orders. I have reasonable confidence that at this stage of the economic cycle, we'll probably get pretty strong durable goods orders growth. That's an input to the model. The things that are more uncertain right now are really more multiple and valuation based, which, you know, is kind of an environment of normal again. You know, what was abnormal was an environment where the Fed was printing money, more money than we'd ever seen. The balance sheet was expanding faster than we'd ever seen. Now we're moving into a more normalized environment. So hopefully the valuation model proves itself to be a little bit more predictable as well. But interest rates, I think, are the big question mark for this year as opposed to economic conditions. And usually economic conditions drive the earnings model. So we should have a little bit more confidence there.
Yeah. Well, it seems like the data has been coming in, you know, the magnitude of the beats or misses is come back to earth to some degree. You know, we saw CPI at 7% right on the nose this week. So I guess that helps build the confidence to some degree.
I hope so. Knock on wood.
So Gina, speaking of earnings, we have the earnings season kicking off this week. And I was looking through one of your notes and you said analysts are raising their forecasts for the coming season despite company guidance moving in the opposite direction. You mentioned the 20% EPS growth that everybody's expecting, but your guidance-based model says an even higher 27% is likely. And you said analyst revenue outlooks continue to stun. So what will you be looking for this season? I know a lot has been made over the last couple quarters of, you know, just even tallying up how many times people mention inflation or the word transitory on quarterly calls. So what should we be looking
for? Yeah, it's a great question. We also have been involved in that game of tallying up inflation mentions and supply chain mentions, as you know, and it has been kind of stunning to follow. But the thing that I think is most important to watch really is, what are analysts' forecasts and company guidance around operating margins going into 2022 and beyond? Because that's the real trigger that I think changed a lot in the markets as of last quarter, where every other quarter of this recovery process has been all about a persistent beat, top line, bottom line, margin beat, everything, and a raise to top line, bottom line margins. The third quarter earnings season, which was between mid-October and mid-November, was different in that all of a sudden we started to see some real change in analysts' confidence going forward. And by that, I mean their revenue estimates continued to rise, but their earnings estimates stopped rising. And those earnings estimates, you know, or at least slowed down the pace of increase. And a lot of that is because operating margin forecasts kind of hit a ceiling, where analysts were persistently increasing their forecast for operating margins for the S&P 500 prior to that season. In the third quarter season, we saw roughly half of S&P 500 estimates for forward operating margins fall. So it's not that analysts are expecting margins themselves to drop, but they're saying, you know what, I'm going to rationalize my expectations for the future. And that rationalization ultimately creates a little bit of friction for stock prices. We just want to watch how much does it rationalize and does it ultimately manifest itself in a reduction in operating margin expectations or not. I think that's absolutely the biggest key to this earnings season. We'll have more on that in our notes for next week after a couple of financials report for Friday. So certainly look out for that. But I do think it's the most important factor to watch. And it's not just important because I care about company fundamentals. And the other thing I think to note about operating margin forecasts is they're a magnificent timing indicator. So, just historically, if you go back over the last 10 years, all of those major corrections in the equity market, 2011, 2015, 2018, excluding the coronavirus related correction, obviously, but those three major peaks in stocks, which preceded a near 20% correction in the S&P 500, were all accurately forecast by a peak in operating margin estimates as well. So I paid very, very close attention to this indicator. And should we continue to see sort of a material downdraft in expectations for margins, you would anticipate a much weaker market climate to emerge. You know, I'm hopeful that we can kind of hold in there and companies can guide us that some of these supply chain frictions are easing, some of the inflation pressures are easing, but you know, I'm not 100% certain that we can be that rose-colored glasses kind of optimistic.
Yeah, this supply chain issues seem to be lingering longer than anyone really expected, you know, and now flaring up again with this new variant of the virus. Hey, Gina, I wanted to rewind a little bit, and you mentioned how, you know, interest rates are obviously, you know, first and foremost on most people's minds this year. And I think we've talked about this in the past about how it's often sort of that rate of change of interest rates. You know, if it looks like it's a disorderly sell-off in the bond market and rates jump really quickly, that's really the scariest thing to equity investors, I think. I mean, is it that simple? You know, could a sort of a slow grind higher in rates be digested, at least from the index level, you know, by the equity market, and sort of a quiet rotation that keeps the index afloat? Or, you know, or does a grind higher eventually tighten financial conditions enough that, you know, either the Fed has to stall its plans and sort of backtrack a little bit, or that we
don't correct? Yeah, you know, I think it's a complicated question, honestly. I would like to say that a slow grind higher should be relatively easily absorbed by equities, but a lot of that depends on what's happening with the curve, as well as what's happening with growth amid that slow grind higher. And I think that this is what the equity market is going to grapple with over the course of the year is, okay, you know, when we throw into our model that we're likely to get a 2 to 2.25% 10-year treasury yield through 2022, that's not particularly impactful to stocks. It's, you know, it's relatively meaningless, does constrain the multiple from moving higher, but doesn't necessarily, you know, crush the market by any stretch of the imagination, as long as the 2-year treasury remains somewhat anchored and only goes up incrementally. We have 3 hikes in the Fed funds rate over the course of the year, and economic growth conditions remain intact, right? So it's really almost impossible to just isolate that 10-year and say, here's its impact by itself, because it really is, why is the 10-year rising? What's happening with the shorter end of the curve? And is it rising because, you know, investors are freaking out about inflation while growth is plummeting? Because that's a really tough environment for stocks. Or is it rising because inflation pressures are still high and growth is skyrocketing? Because that's a great environment for stocks. So I just think it's all about context. And unfortunately, you know, we can isolate it, and we do. We isolate it in our models, and certainly a 3% 10-year, considering our economic forecast, would be pretty restrictive to equity multiple valuations at this point in time. But if a 3% 10-year comes along because you've got 40% earnings growth, that's a totally different environment, right? And so I think that you do have to kind of consider the context from in which those rates are moving higher.
Speaking of your outlook, I do want to ask you about what you're actually foreseeing for the S&P 500 for this year, because just about everybody I talk to has been saying it's going to be just so much more choppier than it's been in 2021. What I hear over and over again is there's storm clouds on the horizon to grapple with, or some sort of iteration of that sentiment. And I know in your year ahead outlook, you said the path is likely to take its fair share of twists and turns as the economy transitions to expansion. So what do you foresee for the S&P 500? And feel free to break it down into sort of, you know, the first half and the second half, as Chris Harvey did on the podcast last week, where he said we might see this cathartic upchuck in the first half of the year, which I love. And so I want to bring it back. But so what are you projecting?
Yeah. Well, I can't promise any clever quips like cathartic upchuck. I can't even say it. Forgive me for that. But what I think the consensus. We're pretty close to consensus. Frankly, we've got slow growth and choppy growth in the S&P 500 as our most likely outcome for stocks over the course of this year. I'd say the likelihood that I'm too bullish is lower than the likelihood that I'm too bearish. I do think that most likely, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong because I'm too cautious. That may be a function of hanging out with you guys all day long, constantly, you know, asking me to really question whether or not I should be so bullish or not. But I do think it's going to be a function of where we end up on operating margins that largely determines what happens this year. And can companies withstand inflation pressure? Will we see wage growth start to overcome? It start to overwhelm other categories of inflation while wages have been very, very dormant over the last several years. All of a sudden, we're seeing a little bit of wage growth. And that's one factor that I think we probably don't pay enough attention to is what will that mean for operating margins going forward? I think that so far what the market has done is absorbed a pretty rocky move in interest rates and a pretty significant sell-off in tech with relative ease. I mean, I think that you've got to take the signals from the rally in financials and energy for what they are, and they're very bullish. So if we can continue that kind of environment where, you know, maybe we rationalize our expectations or valuations in some bloated sectors, but start to see more investment flowing into some of these cyclical spaces, we could have a much better market landscape than I think many of us are anticipating. I think the likelihood for recession is very, very low. I think the Fed, if anything, will err on the side of caution as opposed to too much aggression. Even though the market is worried they might get aggressive, they've shown very little sign of thinking about getting too hawkish. And as long as those are your baseline conditions, I think you've got to be pretty constructive toward risk assets. And then I go back to one other thing, and that is the fact that there is just no evidence that households are overly bullish toward equities. If anything, they just don't want to own stocks. They'd rather throw everything at crypto and NFTs and some of these other risk assets and just leave the poor stock market behind as if it just doesn't matter anymore. You know, I hate to sound like the redheaded stepchild, but I kind of am and have been for a long time now, where people just don't want to own stocks that much. So as the bond market becomes less and less investable, you know, as they start to lose a little bit money in the bond market, they start to think about where are my other investment opportunities. And some of that capital could continue to trickle into the equity market, kicking and screaming. But nonetheless, it ultimately lands in the equity market, and that could produce more upside than we're anticipating as well. So I'm not, you know, overly worried about a major shift in stocks occurring this year, except for with respect to margins. It's the one thing that I really want to watch very carefully for risks emerging.
Everyone spends so much time and effort analyzing sort of the fundamentals of the companies and the economy, and not a lot of time looking at the fundamentals of the investors in the world. You know, this savings rate that went through the roof and corporate balance sheets that are really, in many cases, very strong and could, you know, boost buyback and dividend programs. Is that come more into your thinking, you know, the sort of the fundamentals of the buy side?
It's something I think about quite a lot, actually. We do a lot of work on supply and demand for stocks because I think it's something that we possibly really underappreciated over the course of the last 10 years is this idea that stocks didn't go up because people bought them. Stocks went up because corporates bought them. Right. And fewer corporates issued stock than bought back shares. So ultimately, that net supply and demand balance worked in favor of stocks, not because everybody had to own them, but because corporates bought them back and didn't issue us new ones.
Yeah.
So there's just no supply. Now, I think that some things have changed over the last 2 years. Many of them are very healthy in that we have finally had new issuance of share class, you know, shares. We've had some IPOs come to the market. It's not all kind of trapped in private hands anymore. There is the capacity for new equity ownership in the public markets with new IPO issuance, but it's still The supply of new shares is still largely underwhelming how much companies are buying back in the form of demand. So it's something we watch very carefully. And then when I think about, you know, sort of getting a handle on what the real retail investment community holds for equities, I just look at household ownership in the flow of funds data because it's the biggest, most comprehensive database. I mean, a lot of people follow things like ETF flows, but ETFs are a third of the overall market. So you can't really get a feel for what ownership looks like. And if you look at household ownership of equities, they've increased on net, you know, excluding gains from the equity market themselves, of roughly 1% a year for the last 2 years. So they have started to add ownership, but over the last 10, that's 0.3% per year. So we've started to see some real interest gathering for the equity market. But if you go back to the 1990s, we were looking at nearly 2% net increases in ownership every single year for a decade. Yeah. So there just seems to me this enormous potential for all of a sudden people might actually like stocks again. You know, how do I capture that in a model? Really tough to do, but I want to respect the data for what it is and acknowledge that if people start to come back to stocks, it could produce incredible upside that none of us are forecasting.
Yeah. And the demographics, I guess, make it tough too with the, you know, the baby boomers on one side of the barbell and millennials. Maybe these millennials like Valdana will find buying stocks.
I'll just take some of that crypto instead money, of Dogecoin. Honestly, if you know, Bitcoin, last time I checked, Bitcoin wasn't doing so great. So stock market looks to be doing all right right now. Maybe we'll get a little bit of that love.
Well, speaking of getting a little bit of that love, Valdana, you know what time it is?
I know exactly what time it is.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Gina, I think I gave you, I hopefully I gave you enough notice about our craziest thing gimmick. Not gimmick, pardon my lack of vocabulary, our tradition. It's a tradition. Valdana, you kick us off. What's your craziest thing you saw in markets this week?
Well, so as Gina mentioned, cryptocurrencies have been under pressure recently, but there's one coin that's up 100% so far this year. I don't know if either of you are aware of it.
I feel like I should know this. I did read the story, but I can't remember. They all blur together in my mind. It's one of the silly meme coins, isn't it?
You could put dog.
Oh, Baby Doge.
Baby Doge, that's right. You could put dog in there somewhere and your guess would be really good. It's called Baby Doge. When I was checking how much it actually had gone up, and when I checked, it was more than 100%, but there were so many decimals involved. I knew you would love this. It was like 0.00000000357 for one baby Doge.
I love all, yeah. Yes. How many cents is that? It's like 1 billionth of a cent.
No idea, yeah. You could buy so many of them, yeah.
Gina, what's the whole crypto experience been like for you? Is it, you know, I feel like a lot of us kind of just ignored it, hoped it would go away at some point. I mean, have you finally had to engage as an equity strategist to some degree?
To some degree. And, I say that investors are, you know, forced into the equity market kicking and screaming. I've been forced to pay attention to crypto kicking and screaming because I am an equity strategist. I kind of live and breathe stocks and what's happening. And even then, in the most boring stocks in the S&P 500. So I'm tend not to be on these sort of fringy risk assets spectrum. That said, we got to a point where the equity market and the crypto market were trading pretty closely together, hand in hand. So I do have to respect it as a measure of risk tolerance. I am a little bit worried about just how much ownership there is in crypto and how many, you know, real dollars have moved into the crypto universe over the course of the last 5 years or so. Is pretty phenomenal, and what that might mean for economic growth if the fate of a certain investor is really tied to crypto, and we have a pretty big crash like the one we've had. Can they hang on, or how much of their overall income and spending base is really dependent upon this asset? I don't know. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty there, but I do pay attention to it. I still try not to, admittedly, but it's hard not to. I mean, there's a lot going on. It's driving a lot of trends in fintech as well. So I think we have to pay attention.
It's turning into a real macro risk, I guess.
I am a little worried it might be.
All right, Gina, have you seen anything crazy this week up there in the Poconos? Yeah. Gina is, I think, our first strategist joining us from the Poconos.
Yeah, there we go.
I'm excited about that.
That's a differentiating factor. The thing that's really, a couple things have struck me this week, and I, again, live and breathe in the equity market, but I think the biggest thing is this just kind of return of the old school financials, right? If you think about what's happening in the financial sector, all of these disruptors are really losing out to old financial companies like Coinbase, Square, Hood, all of them making new lows, while Goldman, MasterCard, Schwab, all of them making new highs, I thought was really fascinating and a pretty big divergence. At the same time, your best performing space is energy. That's the space nobody wants to own. Good old fashioned energy companies. These are the oil producers of the world. These are the gas pump station owners, right? It's like, wow, what an interesting world we've moved into from metaverse and all of the high-flying growth fintech stocks really taking all of our mind share for so long. I mean, I have to say it's a very comfortable world for me. I'm really enjoying this transition. It's been fascinating to watch just how much things have really shifted over the course of just a week.
Yeah, absolutely. The old, what's old is new again, exactly. Or whatever that old expression is, I guess. That's pretty good. All right, well, I'll give you mine. Vildan, I'm inspired by you. You seem to think anything involving any public company is fair game for crazy
for
things.
For sure.
Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
All right. So I'm going to go with, remember, it was a few days ago, there was this big traffic jam on I-95 in Virginia. It snowed like 7 inches in Virginia. Yeah. People were stuck in traffic for like 24 hours. One poor guy was stuck in that traffic in an Uber. With the meter running in an Uber.
Wow.
Right? But when you think about it, though, you know, you hit the Uber and you get a price, you're expecting that to be your price that you get. But no, they can apparently jack it up. If it takes too long to get there, to get to their destination, they will add some fees onto it. So this guy was stuck in an Uber for 9 hours on I-95 in that snowstorm. So, as you know, it's time to play Price is Right. What do you think the bill was for a 9-hour Uber ride on I-95, Vildana?
Wow.
What do you think they hit him?
This is really good. This is your best one ever. Wow. Okay, let me think. But there must come a point where you could even like fight Uber for like capping it, right? I don't know.
Well,
I'm going to say...
He did, and he got a refund. But what would you guess they tried to bill?
Okay, I'll go with $670.
Okay. I'm going to keep a poker face. Gina, what do you think the Uber bill for a 9-hour...
I was going to go with like
$2,000. I would have thought that too. I would have thought they would have, you know... Because, I don't know. You try to do the math in your head of what's a 15-minute Uber ride, but... they tried to hit him for a $600.
Whoa, Vildana, wow. Nicely done. Amazing.
I can't believe it. I usually am like really under with all
I would have bid what Gina, I would have been in Gina's camp. I would have thought it would have been in the thousands, but it was
still a hefty
bucks.
Bill.
And the guy complained and they gave him a refund, but they won't say how much they refunded him. But it was originally supposed to be a $200 ride. So
wow.
pretty expensive ride to, I think the moral for all of us is check that weather forecast before you get an Uber. You know, can imagine if that was a New York taxi cab for 9 hours. That would have been like a $10,000taxi cab.
Hopefully the Uber driver was $8 pretty just charming. To get in one. You know, then they got along. Maybe they're best friends now, you know. there could be a silver lining to this.
Pal.
Well, yeah. We'll have to reach out to this guy. This was via USA Today, who got it from WTOP News, whatever that is. So maybe they'll do a follow-up. Hopefully.
This is really good.
And speaking of follow-ups, Gina, we're going to have to get you back again soon. Always a pleasure to catch up with you. We don't get to talk to Gina much anymore since we're all hiding in our
homes. Oh, well, thank you very much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you, Gina.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website, and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at @RingAnonymous. Vildana Heyrich is at Vildana Heyrich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellet of Bloomberg Radio. What Goes Up is produced by Magnus Hendrickson. The head of Bloomberg Podcast is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.